Hello, I'm Merrick Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article, which is a follow-up, is How to Ditch Ultra-Processed Foods by Andrea Peterson. Then Julie Wernow wrote, Pregnant women are turning to cannabis to ease pain and anxiety. Robin Friedman has, When You're Living All Together Now. And John Martin wrote, What Factories Taught Me. Then we'll follow that up with an article by Needy Subbaraman, Scientists Have Unlocked the Secret of Great Chocolate. All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first, How to Ditch Ultra-Processed Foods. The American diet is full of ultra-processed foods, frozen pizza, deli meat, energy bars, and energy drinks, packaged bread. These highly processed foods make up about 55% of calories Americans consume each day, according to federal data. A lifetime without candy and chips may be a depressing prospect, but nutrition researchers say people need to cut back. Diets high in ultra-processed foods are linked to increased risk of health problems ranging from obesity and type 2 diabetes to cancer, cardiovascular disease, and depression. Several studies have found that the more you consume, the higher the risk. Even if you do a little step, it will already have a benefit for your health, says Mahildi Pouvier, research director at the French National Institute of Health and Mental Research. She is leading a project called the NutriNet Sunday Cohort, examining diet's effect on health. Nutrition researchers generally define ultra-processed foods as those containing ingredients you would not find in a home kitchen, like high fructose corn syrup or soy protein isolate. They often contain additives that enhance a food's flavor, color, or texture. The food industry has pushed back against criticism of ultra-processed foods, saying that processing has helped make food safer, more convenient, and more affordable. Classifying foods as unhealthy simply because they are processed misleads consumers and exacerbates health disparities, said Sarah Gallo, Senior Vice President of Product Policy at the Consumer Brands Association, a trade group that includes many food makers. Nutrition scientists say that not all products pose the same threat, and some may even be relatively healthy. Here's how to rethink and reduce your ultra-processed foods habit. Big offenders. Sugary drinks and processed meats are the most problematic foods with the most robust scientific evidence showing they're harmful. That's the first place to stop, says Darlesh Mazafrian, a cardiologist and director of the Food is Medicine Institute at Tufts University. Frequently drinking sugar-sweetened beverages, including energy and sports drinks and tea concoctions, is associated with higher risk of obesity, type 2 diabetes, and heart disease. Randomized controlled trials have confirmed the connection between sugar-sweetened beverage consumption and weight gain. Processed meats include bacon, hot dogs, and sausages, along with more virtuous-sounding lunchtime staples like deli turkey. Mazafrian says you should avoid them all or cut back to less than once a week. When meats are cured, smoked, and preserved, they are typically loaded with sodium. Excess sodium increases blood pressure, which increases the risk of heart disease and stroke. Nitrates, preservatives that are often used in processed meats, are linked to an increased risk of colon cancer. The Meat Institute, an industry trade group, says processed meats are safer and deliver protein and other important nutrients. Junk food. Most ultra-processed foods would qualify as junk food if it's high in sodium, saturated fat, or added sugars, and low in fiber, vitamins, and minerals, it generally isn't good for you. Cookies, cakes, and salty goodies were looking at you longingly. Refined grains like white bread, which are often ultra-processed, are also good to avoid. They cause spikes in blood sugar, dysfunction in the gut microbe, and can actually cause you to digest more calories overall. Limit certain foods. When choosing ready-to-eat snacks and meats, check the label and aim for products that clock in at less than 1.5 calories per gram, says Kevin Hall, a former scientist at the National Institutes of Health, who led the agency's research on ultra-processed foods before he left. Ultra-processed foods are often energy-dense, containing more calories per gram than less processed foods. The particular combinations of fat, sugar, sodium, and carbs that ultra-processed foods often contain are not generally found in nature. Researchers call these combinations hyperpalatable, and they exert a strong effect on our brain's reward system, which makes us crave them, says Tara Fazzino, Associate Director of the Cofran Logan Center for Addiction Research and Treatment at the University of Kansas. The easiest way to avoid hyperpalatable foods is to look for products low in sodium, like some soups and frozen meals, he said. Look for foods that take longer to chew, too. Other recent research has found that ultra-processed foods that are soft, packaged smoothies, soft breads, make us eat faster and consume more calories than crunchy breakfast cereals or hard multigrain rolls, for example. Check labels. Artificial sweeteners, particularly aspartame, are associated with an increased risk of cancer in France's Nutrinet Santé research. Titanium dioxide, used by food makers to brighten colors, is banned in the European Union for use in food. Some research, mainly in animals, has linked eating it to immune system problems, inflammation, and DNA damage. Consuming some emulsifiers, a substance used to improve the texture of food, is linked to higher risk of heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and most cancers. The most concerning emulsifiers include carboxymethylcellulose and polysorbate 80, says Andrew Giewitz, a professor at Georgia State University who has conducted related research. Healthier options. Some ultra-processed foods do rank as healthier than others, said Maya Badabulu, associate professor of nutrition at the University of Rhode Island. In that bucket, some whole grain breads, low-sugar yogurts, tomato sauces, nut butters, and plant-based meat alternatives. Hall, the NIH scientist, says he uses some ultra-processed food to make it more convenient to eat more minimally processed, healthier foods. He'll pour low-sodium jarred marinara sauce, which would qualify as ultra-processed, over whole grain pasta and lots of vegetables. The benefits of being able to make a meal in 30 minutes versus 2.5 hours is huge. And now, pregnant women are turning to cannabis to ease pain and anxiety. Pregnancy was a complicated time for Tasha Taylor. The 33-year-old was already managing her bipolar disorder with a psych medication when she got pregnant. Then Taylor learned the prescription drug could hurt her baby. She decided to get off the medication, which led to night terrors. She'd wake up shaking from nightmares of her abusive ex-partner. She struggled to eat. Taylor went on to get a medical marijuana card. The cannabis helped her sleep during her pregnancy and tamp down feelings of mania. She would only take a little before bed, said Taylor, who lives in the small home where her parents raised her, on the southeastern edge of Elkins, about half a mile from the cannabis dispensary. There's so much work stuff that people could be doing than a plant God put on the earth, she said. Taylor is among the increasing number of women using cannabis during pregnancy. Many are driven by a fear of how prescription drugs could affect their baby's health, and they can't consider it safe to aid with pain, extreme nausea, and sleeplessness, among other conditions. An analysis of data from the National Survey on Drug Use and Health shows that cannabis use during pregnancy has risen in recent years and is highest in the first trimester. According to data from NSDUH, 5.4% of pregnant women were using marijuana in 2019 versus 3.5% in 2002. Due to changes in methodology, marijuana use from earlier years can't be compared with 2020 and onward. The rise is a growing concern for public health officials. Though research is limited, recent science indicates that it could disrupt the earliest stages of fetal brain development, especially if the cannabis is of higher potency. Other research has found that cannabis can increase the chance of premature birth, which could bring on more complications. Still, women are turning to cannabis when they feel they have little recourse. A 2022 survey of 3,571 pregnant and recently pregnant women, about 17% said they used cannabis at least once during pregnancy. More than half said they were using it exclusively for medical reasons. Top among them were stress and anxiety, nausea, lack of sleep, vomiting, and pain. Others cited the cost of access to medical professionals versus that of cannabis. The benefits of cannabis for nausea and pain are well documented, but the science is murky for many mental health conditions. Studies about cannabis use or prescription drug use among pregnant women are few and far between. Less than 1% of drug trials include pregnant participants, according to a Brown University School of Public Health analysis of 9,860 drug trials published back in April in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. That leads some women turning to doctors, online forums, cannabis companies, and fellow expectant mothers for conflicting advice. In these studies, we don't know how much they were consuming, how they were consuming it, said Kristen Reiswick, founder of Mary Jane Doulas in Colorado, which guides pregnant women who are using cannabis. There's just so many gaps. How dispensaries operate around the country also adds to the confusion. In many states, cannabis use during pregnancy requires healthcare providers to alert Child Protective Services. Some dispensaries display signs warning pregnant women off cannabis. But in a 2018 study, two-thirds of Colorado dispensaries recommended using cannabis to an anonymous caller claiming to be 8 weeks pregnant and experiencing morning sickness. When Kat Allen was 8 weeks pregnant, she was diagnosed with hyperemesis gravidarum, or extreme nausea and vomiting. She vomited 15 to 20 times a day and dry heaved all day long, despite taking 3 prescribed medications. "I lived on the couch and then the bathroom. It was really hard," said the 36-year-old of Arvada, Colorado. She turned to friends and family in the cannabis industry, doctors, and the internet for advice. The doctors offered little guidance. In Facebook groups of expectant mothers, some recommended cannabis to ease the symptoms. Some sources seemed credible, others felt misleading, and random internet searches usually just brought up scary or judgmental takes, Allen said. "Was a constant process of weighing what I read, comparing it to lived experiences, and trying to make sense of it all for myself." She started using cannabis and told her doctors, who approved of her decision since it was helping. When her daughter was born premature and had to use a feeding tube, Allen worried her cannabis use was to blame. CPS was called and interviewed her in the hospital, but never pursued a case. Today, Allen's daughter, Meadow, has grown into a smart and outgoing 6-year-old. "She's one tough cookie," Allen said. And now, when you're living all together now, whether it's college graduates taking over the basement because they can't afford to buy or rent, while grandparents seeking the security of family as they age in place, multi-generational households in the United States have skyrocketed. According to the Pew Research Center, between 1971 and 2021, the last year for which these statistics are available, the number of people living in multi-generational households quadrupled. The trend is driven by financial issues, the need for caregiving for both children and older adults, and delays in new household formation by young adults. The arrangement comes with challenges. 23% of adults in multi-generational households say it is stressful all or most of the time, and 40% admit it is stressful some of the time, according to Pew. That is why flexible floor plans that enhance privacy, a healthy respect for boundaries, and candid discussions upfront among family members are key to the success of any multi-generational arrangement. Darlene Gibson, 56, and her husband, Jim Gibson, 58, have been sharing their 2,000-square-foot home in Goodyear, Arizona, with Jill's mom, Cheryl, since they purchased it for $422,490 in 2021. Before moving in, Cheryl, 79, was living on her own in rural Virginia, where she was isolated and dependent on others to get around. Together, the family is living together in a style of home that is becoming more popular as multi-generational living becomes more common. Miami-based Lennar has sold its next-generation home design since 2011, according to Alan Jones, the company's division president in Tempe, Arizona. These models include an attached private suite with a separate entrance, kitchen, living room, bedroom, bathroom, and laundry facilities. Jones said that while prices vary by market and model, the price of a typical 3,000-square-foot next-gen home is approximately $15,000 more than a similarly sized home without the multi-generational features. Many homes sold by Fort Washington, Pennsylvania-based Toll Brothers can also be customized for multi-generational living. Many existing homes are suitable for multiple generations as well. According to Realtor.com, nationally, about 3.8% of homes listed between January 1 and June 21st of this year advertised an additional dwelling unit, in-law suite, or casita in the listing description, and homes featuring one of these additional dwelling units and median listed prices 20.6% higher than the market median. News Corp, owner of the Wall Street Journal, also operates Realtor.com. Cheryl Gibson now has the equivalent of her own apartment where she bakes and gets together with friends. She's lost weight because she's active in the community using the clubhouse for bingo and craft night. When she needs to go to a doctor's appointment, Darlene and Jim are there to support her. But the arrangement only works, Darlene said, because of mutual respect. Except for emergencies, no one enters the other party's living quarters without knocking first and being invited. If you're planning to share your home with relatives of different generations, here are some things to consider. Agree on all financial and legal details up front. Lori Dorner, a real estate attorney with Dorner Law and Title Services in Concord, Massachusetts, suggests that the parties outline everyone's expectations, responsibilities, and financial obligations in a written cohabitation contract. The agreement should include an exit strategy to lay out what happens if one of the parties dies, gets divorced, needs to move to assisted living, or just wants to leave the shared home. If title to the property is held by all parties jointly, that exit strategy should include a method of valuing the home in case one party wants to buy the other out, according to Zachary D. Shore, a real estate attorney in Los Angeles. Plan to revisit the agreement every year or so to update it to reflect changing finances and needs. Decide whose names go on the deed. If you need your parents' help to qualify for a mortgage, it is likely the lender will require them to be on the deed and mortgage. Decide whether you want to own the property as joint tenants with right of survivorship, where the surviving party automatically owns the entirety of the property if the other dies, or tenants in common, where a deceased owner's share goes to his or her heirs, which could possibly leave the survivor as a co-owner with strangers. George said that holding title in the name of a trust is a good option as well, assuming the lender will allow it. With a trust, there would be a mechanism for who gets what if someone dies or wants out, he said. Create an emergency fund. Donna Butch, senior fellow at Generations United, a nonprofit that advocates for intergenerational programs and multi-generational living, suggests that families create an emergency fund to which everyone contributes to cover unexpected repairs. That fund could also be used to modify the home to allow older adults to age in place or to childproof the home for young children. Updating a home for one generation can positively impact multiple generations, she said. That front-loading washing makes it easier not just for older adults, but for children who want to help. Accessibility enhances everyone's ability to enjoy the home they share. And now we have what factories taught me. The decline in American manufacturing ushered in more than lost jobs and shuttered factories. It was the death knell for the tradition that built the country. Americans working with their hands, earning a living through their own hard labor. Back in 1969, I had just graduated college and I was tired of intellectualizing. I remember the feeling I had at the time, mental exhaustion from all the thinking and talking. I began working as a machinist in New York. Over the next 7 years, I machined dials, shaping the metal for movie cameras on Manhattan's West Side, refurbished industrial sewing machines in the Garment District, and built gadgets in a basement shop off of Washington Square Park for the New York University Chemistry and Physics Departments. I like manufacturing, got a jolt from the power of the factories. Working with metal, fashioning raw stock into finished shapes, was satisfying. I was drawn to the precision. At a Bronx shop, I cut down a steel bar stock to a diameter that couldn't vary by more than 3/10,000ths of an inch. I am grateful for those years as a machinist. I embraced the hardiness, the gruffness of the work. The years in the plants settled me, stretched and strengthened my mind. I wonder if Americans miss that kind of job more than they realize. People today seem scattered, pulled in several directions at once. Factory work focused my mind, put my feet on the ground. The work was hard and the equipment was dangerous. I had to think straight. I was accountable. The country seemed stronger when it was more working class. I think of my parents and the generation formed in the fields and factories of the Great Depression and World War II. Amid the chaos of today's world, I wonder if America is as reliant, as self-sacrificial, without those people and the work that framed it. Maybe leaving those jobs behind was the market's invisible hand at work. The country's industrious spirit freed most Americans from strenuous labor, moving them forward into knowledge-based work. Or maybe America's role was to pass those physical jobs to someone else, the next emerging country and aspiring people. Manufacturing has become the world's hot potato, tossed in a searing aluminum wrapper from one set of outstretched hands to another. It's been thrown to America again as the country attempts to rebuild manufacturing and restore the communities devastated by its decline. I'm grateful to have held it in my hands. In shaping metal, I shaped myself. And now we have scientists have unlocked the secret of great chocolate. What's the secret to the best tasting chocolate? It is using the right microbes, and for the first time, scientists have isolated a collection of those bugs and made a superior tasting chocolate in a laboratory. Chocolate, like sourdough or yogurt, begins with fermentation. Farmers stash cocoa beans scooped out of ripe cocoa pods in wooden boxes outdoors, cover them with leaves, and leave them alone for a week. Fermentation is kicked off by bacteria and yeast that live in the boxes or the soil. If things go well, the beans and slimy white pulp that surround them will transform into brown beans that can be dried, roasted, and cracked open. The flavorful nibs are turned into chocolate liquor, the foundation for confections and baking chocolate. Working with 3 farms in Colombia, researchers at the University of Nottingham collected samples of farm fermented beans multiple times during the week-long process. The South American nation is a major exporter of fine flavor cocoa, the kind used in more expensive chocolate. Through a genetic analysis, the scientists zeroed in on microbes that were present throughout fermentation. They narrowed the list to those able to produce chemicals found in fully fermented chocolate and used a starter culture made of 9 species to ferment beans in the lab. Lo and behold, they tasted like fine flavor cocoa, said David Salk, a plant molecular biologist and emeritus professor at the University of Nottingham, who was part of the research team. Fine flavor cocoa has fruity, caramel, and floral notes that taste more complex than bulk cocoa grown in countries such as Ghana, according to the International Cocoa Organization. A panel of taste experts at the Cocoa Research Center in Trinidad and Tobago scored the chocolate liquor made with the lab fermented beans and determined that the cultures from 2 farms had floral and fruity flavors similar to fine flavor varieties found in Madagascar. Chocolate owes its taste in parts to its terroir, the particular natural environment it is grown in, such as the soil. And other labs have shown how cocoa products from different locations have different collections of microbes on them. But this is the first time key microbes have been isolated and had their role reproduced. No one has so far reverse engineered it and got a successful startup culture, said Pablo Cruz Morales, a biochemical engineer at the Novak Nordic Foundation Center for Biosustainability at the Technical University of Denmark, who was not involved with the work. The breakthrough, which the researchers described in the journal Nature Microbiology this very month, could help farmers standardize the natural fermentation process. But Cruz Morales would just like to taste the chocolate. I wish they had sent a little sample, he said. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I will be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.